I now give the floor to our professor, Mr. Georgios Galitis, who will present the topic Traditional Monasticism and Religious Organizations in the Era of Elder Joseph de Hesychast. The floor is yours, professor. Mr. Galitis was my professor 30 years ago when I was a young student, so as not to say, well, 35, 55, Father Athanasios says we had him as our professor. Your Eminence, Holy Chairman, Your Eminence, Reverend Abbot of the Holy and Great Monastery of Vatopedi, Reverend Fathers, Venerable Gerontissas, ladies and gentlemen, the subject I have been asked to address is extremely broad. It requires specialized and exhaustive research which would fill a long, substantial book. It would make an excellent doctoral dissertation. In the 20 minutes available to me, I can offer no more than a few observations. They do not begin to exhaust the subject, but they may prompt reflection and further study among those who are interested. With these clarifications, I shall turn at once to the first part of my subject concerning traditional monasticism, and Elder Joseph on the Holy Mountain. Here I shall allow his spiritual descendant, the very Reverend Abbot of the Holy Monastery of Vatopedi, Father Ephraim, to speak. In several passages of his recent book, A Sense of Immortal Life, he writes, Elder Joseph lived during a period of crisis and decline in Athonite monasticism, and more generally, in Orthodox Hesychastic monasticism. This decline had its roots in the anti-monastic spirit that prevailed under Bavarian rule. To this I would also add the influence of the Enlightenment, which the Greeks also experienced according to Father Ephraim. This spirit entered the monasteries as well, causing monasticism to move away from the Hesychastic tradition and thus altering its character. Elder Emilianos, former abbot of the Holy Monastery of Simonopetra, likewise describes the era in which Elder Joseph lived in a passage Father Ephraim read to us earlier as difficult times from a monastic point of view. Elder Joseph himself writes, "Or shall I tell you of my tears and the pain of my soul? What shall I cry aloud so that the mountains may be rent day and night? I weep because I did not find the holy mountain as the saints describe it. I sought to find a spiritual father to teach me heavenly theoria, divine contemplation and praxis, the active ascetic life. At last, after 2 years of arduous searching and a baptismal font of tears, I decided to settle with a simple, good and guileless elder together with another brother. Yet it appears that the situation had not been ideal even before then. We can infer this from the struggle of the Collivates to change entrenched attitudes and from the hostility they face from the monastic establishment of their time. These men struggled to restore the authentic monastic tradition. The spirit opposed to monastic order and tradition gave the Collivates this name in mockery, although in the end it became a title of honor. That same spirit prevailed in the time of Elder Joseph and contributed to the distortion of Orthodox monasticism. It reached the point where the elder endured the mockery and scorn of other monks who regarded him as deluded. Following the example of the Collivades, St. Siluan, the Athonite whom the elder mentioned to us earlier, and in an earlier age, St. Gregory Palamas, all of whom the Athonites had regarded as deluded, Elder Joseph continued unwaveringly along his path. In one of his letters he writes, "I seek God and I care nothing for men, whether they insult me, reproach me, slander me, dishonor my name, or even if all creation occupies itself with speaking against me." Yet amid this spirit there was also an exception, or rather, a small faithful remnant, though very few such exceptions did exist, and Elder Joseph attached himself to them. He thus became an instrument of God, who blessed him so greatly that he himself became the spiritual forefather of a vast multitude of monks, the renewer of many holy monasteries, and one of the pioneers and chief agents of the recovery and rebirth of Athonite monasticism. According to the wise saying of the late Saint Justin Popovich, the rebirth of monasticism means the rebirth of the entire body of the faithful who bear the name of Christ. I shall pass over some things here. The elder has already told us of the multitude of monks who arose and went out to the monasteries, the 6 monasteries, and the 1,000 monks who continue the work of Father Joseph. The blessed elder now enjoys the fruits of his ascetic martyrdom in the bosom of Abraham. But the Hesychastic tradition, which he revived through his way of life and through his many spiritual descendants, took root, grew, bore abundant fruit, and filled the cenobitic monasteries and skates, the cells, small hermitages, and caves of the Holy Mountain, spreading even to the ends of the inhabited world. Up to this point, I have presented what has already been written. The elder, Father Ephraim, has written a great deal, as have others. Yet I cannot resist the thought of speaking in a somewhat more personal way. The era in which Elder Joseph pursued his ascesis, his ascetic discipline, was also, in part, my own era. The end of the 1930s, where the memories I shall relate begin, and the decades of the 1940s and 1950s coincided with my childhood, adolescence, and early youth. I therefore wish and am able to offer my personal testimony. I do not have the privilege of being a monk, but I grew up in a family that held monasticism in boundless honor. I say this to show that reverence for monasticism also existed at that time, and not only an anti-monastic spirit. My late father, who was 4 years younger than Elder Joseph, had drunk deeply from the spiritual streams flowing from the monastery of St. Mark on Chios. The elder there was Father Gabriel, a disciple of Venerable Parthenios, the new ascetic and founder of that monastery. Many monks came to our home, among them Father Philotheos Zervakos, a compatriot of Father Joseph from Longobarda, as well as monks from other monasteries that I do not wish to name now. They were all devout and virtuous men. Apart from the law books my father needed for his work as a judge, a very large part of his library consisted of patristic texts, especially those of the Neptic Fathers, the Fathers of Watchfulness. Every moment he could spare from his professional duties, he immersed himself in monastic books, the Philokalia, the Evergetinos, the Ladder of Divine Ascent, Isaac, the Syrian, Ephraim, the Syrian, Simeon, the New Theologian, and also Unseen Warfare. Spiritual exercises, the ascetical works of Basil the Great and Dionysius the Areopagite, I still have all these books, and they are covered with marks from his many underlinings. We children read simpler works, such as the Lives of the Saints from the Eclogion and the Kallokairini of Agapios Landos. Naturally, we also had all the publications of Squinas of Volos, with whom my father maintained a personal friendship. And of course, the prayer rope was not unfamiliar to us at the table where the whole family always ate together. Instead of fairy tales, we usually heard stories from the sayings of the Desert Fathers or accounts of Atonite elders. Thus, Karulia and Katunakia assumed almost mythical proportions in our childhood eyes. Why do I say these things, and what value does my personal experience have? Through everything I have said, I wish to indicate that monasticism at that time may have been in decline generally. Yet just as a small faithful remnant existed on the Holy Mountain and elsewhere, so too did such a remnant exist in the world. The lamp of hesychasm was not extinguished. It may have flickered, but its light was sufficient to illumine souls to be passed on later and to blaze up into a consuming flame. The monks of that time may not have known very much. They may have occupied themselves with nothing but prayer, study, and handiwork, but what more did they need? Many may even have entered the monasteries illiterate, uncultivated, and cast aside by life. Yet they formed the leaven that prepared the way for Elder Joseph, who came afterward and rekindled the hesychastic spirit through noetic prayer. Kontoglou came later and taught a return to Byzantine iconography, which had been abandoned even on the Holy Mountain, and there were many others. I ask your pardon, forgive this personal reference, but I consider it important to offer the testimony of my own experience as well. I must hurry now to reach the second part concerning religious organizations. The subject is immense. It is usually discussed in the heat of controversy, and there is a whole range of positions from the most passionate on the left to the most passionate on the right. Respecting everyone's views, I declare that I shall try to be as objective, impartial, and uninfluenced as possible, while again speaking from the personal experience I had during my student years. Many of those present who belong to my generation have certainly had the same experience, at least directly or indirectly. For the sake of brevity, I shall omit questions of terminology and history. They would be very interesting, and I have written about them. Perhaps, if possible, that material may be published in the conference proceedings. I shall move directly to the era of Elder Joseph. At that time, many brotherhoods were active throughout Greece. The Brotherhood of Zoe, however, set the dominant tone on a nationwide scale. The associations of the then Archimandrite Father Augustinos Kantiotis and of the married priests Father Angelos Nisiotis and Father Georgios Makris were more limited in scope. It was to them that Greece owed the introduction of the institution of catechetical schools. In Thessaloniki, there were the Redemption Association and Father Timotheos Papamikal School of Christ. Father Gervasios Paraskevopoulos was active in Patras, and others were active elsewhere. The large number of organizations, and especially their creation, expansion, and broad acceptance by the Greek people during the 1940s and 1950s, primarily until the repose of Father Joseph, whom I call a saint, for God will surely have numbered him among the saints, coincided with the elders' era, when these organizations were at their height. Their creation, expansion, and broad acceptance, therefore, is a phenomenon that cannot be explained in only one dimension. First of all, the observation that nature abhors a vacuum applies here as well. What then was the condition of the church when these organizations were founded? Let us not forget that the organizations addressed themselves not to the monasteries, but to the people. How were the people spiritually nourished? When did they hear a sermon, and what kind of sermon was it? How often did they attend church, receive Holy Communion, and go to confession? And to be honest, how much spiritual life was there even in the monasteries, especially those outside the Holy Mountain, and particularly those that followed, as I might put it, an idiorhythmic way of life? The organizations responded to the need for spiritual nourishment and guidance by giving the people what they believed the people needed. This was certainly neither neptic theology, nor noetic prayer, nor all-night vigils. As we have already said, these things had been neglected or lay dormant even within monasteries. Nevertheless, the Brotherhood's desire to offer spiritual nourishment to the people should not be viewed apart from the broader current of spiritual ferment that began with the Collivades, even if these organizations later moved away from it to a greater or lesser degree. Examples of the spiritual searching of the 19th century, in which we find the seeds of these organizations, a searching that began with the Collivades and stirred the waters, include the movements associated with Papoulakos, Flamiatos and others, but especially with Makrakis. I think we may say that Makrakis was, in a certain sense, the forefather of the organizations that came later. I do not wish to address this here. It too is a major subject about which I have written, and I do not wish to expand upon Makrakis' relationship with the organizations. I come instead to a specific question. What was the deeper relationship between ZOE as the representative organization and monasticism? We may sum it up in two words: mutual suspicion. The monks could not accept the idea of monks living in the world without cassocks. For them, the only form of monastic life and consecration was the hesychastic way, at least as they understood it. They either did not know or failed to consider examples from church history, such as the monks of the Basileias, for instance. The organization members, as they were called, on the other hand, looked at the general decline of monastic life, which did not differ greatly from the corresponding decline of church life, and could not imagine encouraging a young man or woman to put on the monastic habit. Thus, every young person who longed to dedicate himself or herself to God understood that dedication as missionary service to the church. Yet there was also a place for those who did not wish to enter a brotherhood and live this consecrated communal life. Around the brotherhood arose a multitude of affiliated organizations, each, one might say, for a particular group: academics, workers, parents, university students, nurses, and teachers. At the same time, a corresponding women's monastic sisterhood called Eusbia was also founded. I will pass over much in order to come to another question. What books did they read, and what books did they publish? His Eminence, the chairman, is signaling that I must finish in a few minutes. May I have one more minute? Yes, and one more besides? Good, thank you very much. So what books did they read, and what books did they publish? Certainly not the Fathers. Patristic writings were unknown. The organization's own books were read extensively, and most of them were moralistic. The sermons and catechism lessons were similar in content. Is moral instruction a bad thing? Not necessarily. If morality is reduced to observing rules detached from dogma, that is not orthodox. But if by morality we mean walking in newness of life, living in Christ, who suffered for us, not in order to give us moral rules, but leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps so that we may walk as he walked, then we are on the right path. Yet this distinction was not always clear within the organizations. As for the prayer rope, there was no mention of it at all. Even its name and appearance were unknown. When someone at a camp was seen holding a prayer rope, a man who is now an archimandrite of the old calendarists, he became the laughingstock of his fellow campers. One accusation many level against ZOE is that of pietism. Unless this is a play on the name of its founder, Father Eusbios Matopoulos, its critics generally mean an emphasis on outward forms and works of piety. But pietism is something else. It was a movement within Protestantism that rejected the outward forms of worship and made salvation dependent on individual effort. It is true that ZOE placed great emphasis on the believer's personal struggle without stressing the ecclesiological dimension of salvation. Although ZOE was not distinguished by a rich liturgical life, its entire effort was directed toward leading people into the church, to holy confession and frequent holy communion, and indeed toward forming devout Christian believers. There is nothing blameworthy about this devotion, nor does it have much in common with Protestant pietism. The same applies to the accusation that Zoe did not offer solid spiritual food, but only milk fit for infants. There is much truth in this. Yet we must not forget that in a time of famine, even milk can help a person survive until suitable food is found. And to be fair, many survived spiritually on this milk until they found solid food. The late Father Linnaeus, who was first a monk in Essex and later on the Holy Mountain, once told me that as a student, he took part in the Zoe movement with the blessing of Elder Sophronis Sakharov, who told him, "There is nothing better in Athens. Be content then, with what is offered to you until something better comes." Nor should we overlook the thousands of people who were benefited by the organizations, everywhere in public and private life, so deeply afflicted by corruption of every kind, we encounter upright people of integrity and consistency who owe their honesty and uprightness to the formation they received from the organizations. Of course, many went astray because they lacked spiritual vitality, but that is another matter. Finally, I come to the most important point and I am nearly finished, Your Eminence. My time is up. I humbly believe that the renewal of monasticism which began in the 1960s has its roots in the religious organizations and for two reasons. First, many who had tasted the sweetness of the organization's milk later sought solid food. They found it in the teaching of the fathers, in mystical theology, and in hesychastic theoria or divine contemplation. As a result, many were led toward monasticism. The second reason for the renewal of monasticism was the division of Zoe. It was within God's plan that the largest, liveliest, and most active brotherhood, which was growing and swelling almost beyond control, should eventually split apart and burst. Its fragments were scattered from Sweden to Africa and Korea, and of course, as far as the Holy Mountain, the most natural destination for those seeking the authentic monastic life. Your Eminence, Your Eminences, ladies and gentlemen, it is easy to cast a stone of condemnation either at the religious organizations for their shortcomings, mistakes, and omissions, or at the monasticism of an age in which it was neither exact nor perfect. In the end, however, everything must be placed within its historical setting and understood within God's plan. Historical circumstances shape a particular situation. People are not to blame for having lived in a particular age, with both its positive and negative aspects. Instead of condemning circumstances, institutions, and even worse persons, let us glorify God for placing us in an age and an environment in which we can find authentic spiritual life and meet people who can impart it to us. Yet, for this very reason, we shall be all the more without excuse. The Word of God in the Epistle to the Hebrews is clear. Everyone who partakes only of milk, as in the case of the organizations, is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is an infant, but solid food belongs to those who are mature, to those who, through habitual use, have trained their senses to discern both good and evil. Trained senses require the habitual nourishment of solid food. Those of us who think we have found it should also hear what follows. The conclusion of this passage from the Epistle to the Hebrews. Therefore, leaving the elementary teaching about Christ, the milk of which we spoke, the first beginning of the spiritual life, let us press on toward perfection. Whoever thinks that he has passed beyond the beginning now has before him a whole field of spiritual struggle. The road to perfection, the road Elder Joseph showed us. May we have his blessing. Let us thank the professor, whose exceptionally vivid presentation has, I believe, given many people food for thought and perhaps prompted them to express those thoughts during the discussion.